It was Biggles who knew first that the machine was coming. His keen ears picked up the drone of the motors. "Here comes Ginger!" he yelled desperately. By which time others in the crowd had heard it too. There was a quick babble of excited conversation. The immediate preparations for the hanging were temporarily abandoned, and several people pointed to the fast-approaching Jupiter. "Never mind about that!" shouted McBain, as if he sensed that the oncoming aeroplane was a danger to the success of his plans. Ferroni demanded that the hanging should proceed, but the attention of the crowd was distracted by the behaviour of the machine. At first, it seemed the pilot was going to glide straight to the aerodrome and land, but at the last moment the machine turned suddenly as if the pilot had observed the crowd and wished to see it at close quarters. Straight over the tree, at a height of not more than 50 feet, the Jupiter soared and then went into a tight circle.
"Well, come on! Ain't you never seen an aeroplane before? Let's get on with the hanging!" roared McBain.
But the noise of the Jupiter's engine so drowned the words that only those in his immediate vicinity heard them. "What does he think he's up to?" Delaney asked Biggles. "I don't know," he answered. "But I rather fancy he's going to throw something out." "Yes, he is." The next moment, a dark object was hurtling downwards, turning slowly as it fell. There was a yell of alarm from the crowd, each member of which took steps to make sure that it did not hit him. The falling object finally crashed to earth in the middle of the scattered spectators. The actual moment of impact produced a curious effect. So curious, in fact, that it is doubtful if any one of the watchers had the slightest idea of what had happened. There seemed to be a sort of brilliant yellow flash, almost like a tongue of flame, which licked along the short turf for a brief moment before it disappeared. The crowd converged on it, and all was hidden from view. There was an excited whisper, almost a hiss, and then a shout went up. Delaney had run forward with the others. "Stand away there," he ordered crisply. Curiously enough, the crowd gave way to him, as though it once more respected his authority. Mass hysteria is a strange thing. It can die down as quickly as it can arise, and thus it was in this case. Delaney perceived his opportunity and was not slow in taking advantage of it.
"Stand clear," he snapped. "Don't touch it, anybody. And that goes for you too, McBain," he went on curtly.
Delaney stooped and picked up something from the ground. It looked like a piece of torn sacking.
"Moose Creek Goldfields," he read in an amazed voice. Then, a tone higher, he added, "Boys, it's the Moose Creek Gold!"
The words were received with a loud buzz of excitement, and everyone pressed forward to see the pile of yellow dust that had burst from the bag when it hit the ground. Delaney strode to where the prisoners were standing, the nooses still around their necks. The crowd, its anger melting in the face of this new mystery, surged after him.
"What do you know about this?" Delaney asked Biggles sternly.
"Not much more than you do," replied Biggles. "I suggest you let the boy tell his story in his own way. Here he comes now."
Ginger, who by this time had landed, was, in fact, marching towards the crowd. In front of him, covered by his automatic, walked the Indian, draped in the long fur coat from the cabin. The crowd fell silent as it watched the approach of this curious procession. On all faces was astonishment not far from incredulity. Straight through the crowd to where Delaney was standing, Ginger marched his prisoner, the spectators forming a lane to allow them to pass. Ginger's eyes opened wide when he saw the dangling ropes.
"What's the idea?"
asked Delaney, the words sounding strangely loud in the hush that had fallen.
"I've brought back evidence to prove that my friends are innocent," cried Ginger. "I've brought back the gold," he went on. "Some of it you may have seen. The rest is in the aeroplane."
"Where did you find it?" demanded Delaney.
"I found it under the floor of an isolated cabin, where the thief had hidden it until such time as it suited him to collect it. This Indian was left on guard over it, and he will tell you to whom the cabin belongs. It belongs to Brindle McBain."
McBain, white with passion, pushed his way to the front.
"What are you saying?" he snarled.
"I'm saying that you stole the gold," answered Ginger in a hard voice. "Instead of flying it straight down here, you landed at your cabin, broke the seals of the boxes, took out the gold, substituted lead, and then resealed the boxes, and here's the seal with which you did the job."
Ginger handed Delaney the duplicate seal.
"That's a lie!" roared McBain.
"We shall see," retorted Ginger imperturbably.
He raised his voice.
"Does anyone here recognize the coat this Indian is wearing?" he demanded. A dozen voices answered, "It's McBain's."
"Now,"
continued Ginger to McBain. On the night Noel Mowes was murdered, I believe I'm right in saying that you were wearing that coat.
McBain hesitated. It was as if he suspected a trap, but could think of no way of avoiding it. He could not deny that he'd worn the coat, for nearly every man present had been in the saloon that night and must have seen him in it.
Well, what if I was wearing it?
He snarled belligerently. Has anyone else but you ever worn that coat? Again, a moment's hesitation. The atmosphere was electric.
It's my coat. Nobody else has had it. That's what you're getting at,
grated McBain. Ginger pointed to the turn-up at the bottom of the fur sleeve. Just feel in there and take out what you find, he said quietly. And then perhaps you'll tell us how it got there. Like a man in a dream, almost against his will, it seemed, McBain's finger went down into the turn-up. The silence was such that every member of the crowd might have been holding his breath. A look of relief passed over McBain's face as he found what was evidently an insignificant object. With a short laugh, he took it out and looked at it. As he did so, his face blanched. Yet the object was simple enough. It was merely an opal-headed tie pin. "Does anyone recognise that pin?" called Ginger loudly. Nearly everyone present recognised it and knew to whom it belonged. The murdered prospector. Delaney raised his hand for silence. Then he took a revolver from the hand of a man standing near him. The man did not protest. "McBain," said Delaney, "I reckon I know why you were so anxious to lynch three innocent men." The crowd surged forward, muttering ominously, nor did it heed Delaney's orders to stand still. Possibly the fact that most of the men felt that they had been duped by McBain had something to do with it. Be that as it may, McBain evidently suspected what his fate might be. It rather seemed as if he lost his nerve. Accompanied by Ferroni, with a wild rush, he swept those who stood around him from his path and drove a lane through the outskirts of the spectators, heading for safety. "Stop!" roared Delaney above the uproar, but the fugitives took no notice. "Look out! They're making for the machine!" shouted Biggles. "And the gold's in it! If you don't stop them, they'll get away and take the gold with them!" McBain and Ferroni were, in fact, running like hares towards the Jupiter, which was still standing out in the middle of the aerodrome where Ginger had left it. And it seemed likely they would have succeeded in their object, but for an unexpected development. From the far side of the aerodrome, riding at a gallop, came five uniformed figures. Delaney yelled a warning. He had now reached the outskirts of the crowd, a position from which he could use his revolver without risk of hitting the wrong man. But although he emptied it at the fast-retreating figures, the range was too long and the shots did not touch their mark. But they served another purpose just as useful. They gave the oncoming horsemen at least an inkling of what was happening, as was revealed by the manner in which they swerved to cut them off. McBain and his pilot swerved too, but they could not hope to compete with horses. Seeing that they were trapped, they both drew their revolvers and tried to shoot their way to the machine. They did succeed in emptying one saddle, but then a fusillade of shots rang out, and McBain pitched face downwards on the turf. Ferroni, evidently seeing that his case was hopeless, threw down his weapon and raised his hands above his head.
"Here, Delaney, haven't we been trussed up like this long enough?" asked Biggles reproachfully.
The constable took out his jackknife and cut the prisoners free.
"That kid of yours was just about in time," he said gravely.
"He usually is," grinned Biggles. "Who are these newcomers?"
"Captain Lanton and the troopers from Blackfoot Point," answered Delaney. "That mechanic of yours must have got through to him. Phew, what a report I shall have to make. You'd better not go away. The captain will want to see you too."
"I suppose you're no longer in any doubt as to who killed old Mose?"
Biggles asked Delaney as they walked across the aerodrome towards the Jupiter, near which the crowd had reassembled.
"None whatever," replied Delaney.
"Then in that case, I assume we are no longer under arrest."
"No, you're free as far as I'm concerned."
"Then if it's all the same to you, we'll get our machine inside its hangar and tidy things up a bit. I suppose I ought to fly up to Moose Creek and tell them the gold is safe."
"Well, best wait until you've seen the captain," advised Delaney.
They stood still as a little procession passed them, carrying a body. They learned that it was McBain, and that he was dead. A bullet had gone through his heart, killing him instantly. Ferroni, with handcuffs on his wrists, was standing near the troopers, towards whom Delaney now continued his way.
"You'll find us in Arctic Airways shed if you want us," Biggles told him as their paths separated, the airman making for the Jupiter with the object of putting it in the shed. This they did, after which, over a hastily prepared meal, Ginger gave an account of his adventures at the cabin. When he had finished, the others, for his benefit, described what had happened in Fort Beaver. They were concluding the meal with coffee when Delaney and his superior officer entered. At the officer's request, Biggles narrated the entire story of their adventures from the time they had received Wilkes's letter in London. The tale took a long time to tell, but both the officer and the constable listened breathlessly, particularly when Biggles related the events that had occurred near Angus Stirling's cabin.
"And what are you fellows going to do now?" the officer asked, when at last the story was told.
"Well, as far as I can see, our work is finished," answered Biggles. "The transfer which we got from Angus Stirling settles any doubt as to who owns the aerodrome, and now that there's only one line operating between Fort Beaver and Moose Creek, the Goldfields people will be glad enough to use it. Anyway, they should be grateful for the recovery of that last consignment of metal, because, but for the Arctic Airways, they would have lost it. I reckon that Canwell, when he hears what's happened, ought to give Arctic Airways a contract for handling all their freight."
"Yeah, I think so too," agreed the officer. "I know the chairman of the company. I'll have a word with him about it at the first opportunity."
Which, in fact, he did a day or two later, with the result that the contract was soon forthcoming, as well as an offer of extra finance for spare equipment, should it be required. And that is really the end of the story. Wilkes implored the others to remain on at Fort Beaver and share the profits of his enterprise, which had been so nearly wrecked. But Biggles was adamant in his refusal to tie himself to any one spot. However, they stayed on until Arctic Airways was reorganized on proper lines, which did not take very long, for Wilkes found no difficulty in getting staff now McBain and his gang had been removed. Wilkes flew the party back to Quebec in one of the two Jupiters the firm now possessed, and it was there that goodbyes were said. "Let me know how things go on," shouted Biggles from the deck of the ship that was to take them back to England.
"I will," promised Wilkes. "Thanks for coming over."
"Don't mention it," grinned Biggles. "It's been a pleasure."